Welcome to Battle for Red October, a podcast about the Russian Civil War. This is Episode 7, How Tsaritsyn Became Stalingrad. 1918 saw a series of battles around the provincial town of Tsaritsyn. Later it was renamed Stalingrad, in honor of Joseph Stalin, who played a role during the events of 1918. The rest is history. This podcast is from the 1919 Review. That's 1919review.wordpress.com. Check out the original blog post for images, maps, citations, edits, credits, and more. Today it takes 5 nights to travel by train from Moscow to Irkutsk. During the years of the Civil War, a more modest journey might take much longer, or never reach its destination at all. Fuel was scarce and the condition of the rolling stock was lamentable after years of war and revolution. To make matters worse, it was over the railways themselves that the ragged hordes of white and red were fighting. They blew up bridges, tore up tracks, fought over junctions and stations, ambushed trains on horseback. A train might be robbed by soldiers or bandits, or a local factory or Soviet acting on its own initiative. In those years, the railways were dangerous. The Soviet government subjected the railways to military discipline in an attempt to mitigate the chaos. If there was a breakdown, or a shakedown, or a delay due to war, carriages full of food might be left to rot on a siding for days or weeks. Passengers who expected to be at their destination in a few hours might suddenly find themselves cast away adrift on a desert island. People of various classes and political affiliations were suddenly abstracted from society and placed in the state of nature for days on end. In the winter, people on stranded carriages froze to death. At any time of year, there were other ways you could wind up dead on the tracks, in the crossfire of a battle, or mistaken for an enemy agent by Reds, by Whites, by Cossacks or Kulaks, for motives of robbery, or as summary justice for some real or imagined crime. It was dangerous to take to the rails. But all classes of people ended up side by side on the bunks for all kinds of different reasons. There were millions of freed prisoners of war returning to the Middle East and Central Europe. There were millions of former soldiers of the Russian Imperial Army going home. In their millions, people moved out of the cities to seek better food and healthier conditions in the villages. There were soldiers on the move. There were refugees, food detachments, petty traders, specialists, revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries on missions. We have gone a little way down this track before. In part 3 we followed the sailor Raskolnikov on his dangerous journey through the south to scuttle the Black Sea fleet at Novorossiysk. The Cossack White Revolt had cut off the south from the center of European Russia. All the major railway lines were in German or Don Cossack hands, bar one. From the summer of 1918, the town of Tsaritsyn was the last major southern city in Red hands. It was Moscow's only link to Baku and to Turkestan. It became a bottleneck for Reds on the railways. They were drawn there in their thousands. Many southern Red Guards, people who had lived through the struggles we have looked at in parts 1, 2 and 3, regrouped in Tsaritsyn. Among them was the Donbass workers' leader Klement Voroshilov. In June, a friend of Voroshilov's, a long-standing Bolshevik named Joseph Stalin, washed up in Tsaritsyn. He wasn't even supposed to be there. But it was one of those contingent railway adventures of the Civil War. 20 years later, the city would be renamed after Stalin and would be the site of one of the most decisive and bloody battles in human history. The name Stalingrad today conjures up powerful images. But during the Civil War, Tsaritsyn was a provincial town with a population probably one-tenth the size of Stalingrad in early 1942, without the towering white apartment blocks or sprawling factories. During the Great War, military industries had grown up in the town, and in 1917 the Tsaritsyn Soviet seized power even before the Petrograd Soviet. In early 1918, thousands of Red Guards were recruited from its workforce and sent into the Don country. The provincial town had become a revolutionary stronghold wedged between the Don Cossacks and Central Asia. It was on the very edge of Europe. It sat on the steep bluffs of the right bank of the Volga River.
A civil war rages between the revolutionary Bolsheviks and the anti-communist white armies. On the banks of the great Volga River, the town of Tsaritsyn stands as one of Russia's most important industrial centers and the gateway to Central Russia. Its counter-revolutionaries, mostly Cossacks and old imperial forces, hope to use this victory to secure southern Russia and ultimately launch an assault on Moscow, the seat of Bolshevik power.
Meanwhile on the Don River, General Krasnov had become autocrat of the Don Cossacks. He was a client of the Germans occupying Ukraine, and there were grand plans for a German-sponsored Don state including Voronezh and Tsaritsyn. The Krasnovite attitude was, quote, it will be easier to put up with German domination than the domination of the Russian Mudlik bandit, end quote. The Krasnov regime had set its sights on Tsaritsyn. With every escalation of the dire crisis in the south, the importance of Tsaritsyn increased. A Red Army specialist named Andrei Nazarov arrived in town in May and found 6,000 armed Red Guards. They were disorganized and incapable of defending the town. Snezarov had been a general in the Tsarist army, but he had come over willingly to the revolution. He wrote to a colleague, quote, it is difficult to immediately understand everything, but if the Russian people follow the Bolsheviks, then I'm with them. After all, the people are not mistaken, end quote. Snezarov insisted on strict discipline and created firm lines of defense on the approaches to Tsaritsyn. He would visit these lines in his full Tsarist general's uniform. This was a courageous move when so many officers had been bayoneted or drowned by their men. But no Red Guard laid a finger on him. The rank and file respected his courage and ability and did not resent his discipline. Behind Snezarov's line, food and fuel and troops could move unhindered. But the Don Cossacks were closing in on Tsaritsyn. Into this war zone, in the early summer of 1918, came Joseph Stalin. Stalin was a member of the Bolshevik Central Committee before the revolution and was now a people's commissar in the Soviet government. He had been sent from Moscow to the war-torn south as the head of a food detachment consisting of 450 armed soldiers. The center, which means the core of European Russia encompassing most of the cities and population, was starving. Meanwhile in the south and the Caucasus the granaries were full. Soon, after visits from food detachments, trainloads of grain were headed north. Like so many others, Stalin and his detachment were diverted to Tsaritsyn and stranded there. It was only a few weeks later that Raskolnikov the sailor passed through Tsaritsyn on his way to sink the fleet. Stalin had already taken charge. I will quote his description at length. Note that it was written in 1934, when Stalin's cult of personality was in force. Quote, early next day the train reached Tsaritsyn. Among the endless parallel tracks near the station I sought out Comrade Stalin's carriage. He received me at once. A map was spread out on his desk. In a black high-collared jacket and trousers tucked into the tops of his high leather boots, his long, upstanding black hair brushed back, and on his energetic face a thick, drooping mustache, Stalin strode towards me and, taking his smoking pipe from his mouth with his left hand, stretched out his right hand. Stalin was everything in Tsaritsyn, the Central Committee's plenipotentiary, a member of the Revolutionary War Council, the director of all party and Soviet activity. As ever, he settled all problems collectively, in close contact with the local institutions, which impressed them and enhanced still further his unquestionable authority. Stalin proposed that we sit down at his desk, and I then told him about the task that had been entrusted to me. I was astonished when I found that Stalin already knew all about it. A day or two ago Shliapnikov passed through here, said Stalin, in a scornful tone. He, too, is against scuttling the Black Sea Fleet. He doesn't understand. Stalin shrugged his shoulders, turned his pipe over and, sticking his forefinger into the bowl, slowly emptied the ashes into the ashtray. Then, pulling his tobacco pouch towards him, he slowly unfastened it and refilled the pipe with small pinches of tobacco. He said, Shliapnikov is now at Torgovaya. You'll catch up with him. Stalin added after a pause, having first lit a match, rekindled his pipe with profound concentration, and drawn deeply upon it. Lines gathered on his brow for a moment. Stalin pointed out to me the mistake made by Vakramayev, who, having arrived at Novorossiysk with a definite directive from the Council of People's Commissars, concealed this for a long time from the leading party comrades in the Black Sea Kuban Republic. This ultra-conspiratorial behavior never pays off, he said, glancing at me with his kindly dark eyes and, wrinkling up his nose, he laughed a pleasant, throaty laugh. End quote. His conversation with Raskolnikov was typical. A mix of charm and merciless backbiting. It's like a scene from Mean Girls. The tone of his remarks about Shliapnikov and others are familiar to anyone who has read Stalin's telegrams to Moscow from this period. The incompetence of others is a theme to which he returns again and again like a needle drawn to a magnetic pole. One wonders if he was being honest, covering for his own mistakes, or stabbing others in the back to ingratiate himself.
Ready?
Yes.
Right. In his compartment, Stalin told me he would do anything and everything to stabilize the Southern Front. He would take measures, stern measures.
But they said that you were only to collect grain, not get involved in military activities.
Stalin does not obey orders unless he agrees with them.
Stalin had, without authorization from anybody, taken command of the local Chika and the Soviet and the Red Army. At once he clashed with Snezarov, the former Tsarist general. Rumors spread that the general was a traitor. Traitor or not, Stalin hated having to answer to a general of the old army. He had Snezarov and other officers imprisoned on a barge on the Volga on charges of treachery. Snezarov was saved from a bullet in the head only by intervention from Moscow. But the former general was recalled from his command. Other officers died on the prison barge. All through June and July there was fighting on the dry steppe. Stalin would tour the shifting front lines in a car. My impression is that the fighting took the form of a daily toll of confused skirmishes. The description by Vasides of the neighboring Voronezh front probably applies to Zaritsyn as well. Quote, revolutionary soldiers run like cowards from tiny Cossack detachments. Thousands of Red Army men give away important positions at the mere approach of a few hundred Krasnovites. End quote, but individual qualities like cowardice were not the real issue. The issue was that the Red Army was still more of a loose coagulation of detachments than a real army. On July 23 there came to Tsaritsyn a small group of government agents bearing 10 million rubles. They were led by Makrovsky, a communist, and Alexeyev, a technical specialist. They had been sent out from Moscow to purchase oil, and become stranded in Tsaritsyn. Makrovsky's impression was of a town where trainloads of fuel sat idle while, quote, a countless number of commissars arrest each other daily because of conflicts of authority, end quote. Stalin and his close friends in the local Chika found out about the 10 million rubles and decided it would be put to better use in their own hands. They dismissed the agents and their signed credentials from Lenin. After several episodes of bullying, plotting and death threats, the 10 million rubles were handed over. But the agents from Moscow had put up a fight, and for this the Stalin and his allies bore them a grudge. But for the time being, the matter seemed to be settled. The money appears to have been paid back. Weeks passed and the fighting intensified on the steppe west of the town. This was the same stretch of land, between the Don and the Volga, over which Hitler's blitzkrieg would rage in 1942. Makrovsky and the specialist Alexeyev and their team, which included Makrovsky's wife and Alexeyev's sons, were still stranded in Tsaritsyn when the Don Cossacks made a determined offensive between August and September 1918. The 10th Red Army at Tsaritsyn numbered 40,000, though I don't know how many were armed. They had 240 artillery guns. For comparison, the standard size of a Red Army at this moment was 10 to 15,000. But every Red Army was in a chaotic state. Armbands and badges still stood in for uniforms. More crucially, there was not yet agreement on a basic question: what form should the Red Army take? Disagreements on this question were an early preview of a debate that would rage at the next Communist Party Congress. Erich Wallenberg sums up the arguments of the military opposition at that Congress as follows. Quote. Number 1. The supporters of the guerrilla point of view opposed compulsory military service and favored the voluntary system. Number 2. They were against the appointment of officers and in favor of their election. Number 3. They were against the appointment of Tsarist officers and in favor of the principle that all army orders should be discussed and approved by the troops before being carried out. A centralized army is the institution of an imperialist state. The revolution must live up to itself by abolishing once and for all trench warfare and the centralized army. Small irregular operations are the true tactics of the revolution. End quote. It is understandable if the reader has a fixed image of Stalin as a hyper-authoritarian centralizer. But in 1918 he was closer to the views of the military opposition. These were the ideas of an clique around his friend Voroshilov. This clique was made up of former corporals and sergeants of the old army, who saw themselves as the natural candidates to be the officers in the new army, and they resented former Tsarist officers being placed over them. How many Red Army units, they demanded rhetorically, had been lost due to the treachery of former Tsarist officers? To such arguments, the war commissar Trotsky would answer with another question: How many units have been lost because the commander didn't post ambush guards, didn't know how to read a map, didn't understand orders? Trotsky held a fundamentally different view. Years of training and education had been invested in these officers by the old regime. Their expertise was valuable. Under Trotsky's policy, they were not called officers, but specialists. They were recruited in huge numbers, conscripted, freed from prisons to serve. Many officers were politically unreliable. That was obvious. But each officer was under the supervision of a political commissar. Threats of imprisonment were hung over the families of the specialists to make them think twice about deserting. For Stalin, this was not enough.
Filippo, Kavalenko, Tsarist officers.
Yes.
Do you trust them? Trotsky does, do you?
Trotsky is war commissar, and he's the commander of the Red Army.
You disagree with Trotsky or not?
Not exactly.
Good. And you agree to the need for vigilance?
Yes, absolutely. Resolute vigilance.
Here's a list of unreliable officers. I want them to be summoned here immediately.
Trotsky should be informed.
Trotsky does not understand. We do.
We have seen how the former General Snezarov wound up on a prison barge. That August, the Tsaritsyn Chika claimed to have uncovered a plot involving white SRs and white officers. The Chika was the Soviet state's security organ. Such plots had unfolded in other towns, with catastrophic results, as we saw in Part 6 with Yaroslav. The Chika behaved like central casting, arresting 70 people and assigning them roles in the alleged plot based on no evidence at all. On August 16, they arrested the two Moscow agents, the communist Makrovsky and the specialist Alexeyev. The evidence against Alexeyev consisted of a confession beaten out of a miserable soldier. 23 people were shot, including Alexeyev. My impression is that Makrovsky and Alexeyev were dragged into this alleged plot as an act of revenge for their defiance of the Tsaritsyn commissars in the matter of the 10 million rubles. Alexeyev was shot because he was supposedly a bourgeois specialist, even though there was no reason to suspect him of disloyalty. That is, aside from a confession that was absolutely worthless because it was obtained by torture. Makrovsky was imprisoned for a month. At one stage he was kept in one of six adjoining cells which contained over 300 people. He learned that the infamous prison barge on the Volga now contained 400 prisoners who shared a single toilet. He tried many times to argue his case before the local Chika. They dismissed him. One Chekist, Ivanov, said, quote, "Comrade, give up talking about the center and the necessity of the locality's subordination to it. In Moscow they do things their way, and here we do it all afresh in our own fashion. Regarding the fact that Lenin gives out mandates to people whom we later arrest, well, that's absolutely correct. Lenin can make mistakes. Sure, he writes decrees well. We read through them and put into action the ones that suit local conditions. But the center cannot dictate anything to us. We dictate our will to the center, for we are the power in the localities." On August 28, Makrovsky learned that Lenin had sent a telegram demanding his release. But it was not to be. Robert Argenbright writes, quote, "In yet another bizarre session with Kervyukov, Makrovsky learned that his fate depended on Stalin's wishes. It was then that Makrovsky fully realized that his nightmare was no accident, for Stalin had been in command from the start." End quote. Makrovsky was not released until late September, over a month after his arrest, after intercessions from Moscow and from a prominent Chekist from Baku. By then the first great assault on Tsaritsyn had been driven back. But the Cossacks had resumed the offensive. Now they surrounded Tsaritsyn. Snezarov's defensive lines had been broken, and there was fighting in the outskirts of town. At the same time Stalin was embroiled in a different kind of battle. On October 4, the war commissar Trotsky sent a telegram to Lenin, quote, "I categorically insist on Stalin's removal." End quote. The usual next step for me, the writer, would be to explain what led to this clash between Trotsky and Stalin. But that's not really the right question. It was not specifically the Alexeyev affair that led to the clash, but the general situation which the Alexeyev affair highlights. Stalin was running a Colonel Kurtz-like fiefdom in Tsaritsyn. Moscow would send military and civilian specialists. Tsaritsyn would rob, imprison and shoot them. No wonder there was chaos in town and Cossacks massing at the gates. The real question is why the conflict came to a head so late. Breaking point came over the question of a military specialist named Sidin. Trotsky appointed him to work with Stalin and Voroshilov. The pair refused to work with Sitin and fired him. Trotsky and Vasides were furious. The appeal to Lenin was successful, and Stalin was recalled to Moscow. As soon as the Don Cossack onslaught died down in late October, he was finished. Voroshilov submitted to the center, but later he kicked up a fuss about specialists again. He was removed from his command in December. The Southern Army Group was told it could elect anyone but him as commander. The fighting around Tsaritsyn continued. Two-thirds of Red forces in the area were concentrated there. In January, without Stalin at the helm, the city withstood another fierce assault. But the blockade of Tsaritsyn kept the Red forces divided, and doomed the Red armies of the Caucasus. Later in 1919, in events we will look at in the next series, the city fell to the Whites. In summary, Stalin was in Tsaritsyn for a few months. It remained in Red hands for a long time after he left. During the months when he was, quote, everything in Tsaritsyn, end quote, there were ghoulish frame-ups and general chaos. A Red army of 40,000 faced Cossack forces of similar size but divided between Tsaritsyn and Voronezh, and with far longer supply lines. The Red army held the city for the time being. But it might have been expected to do more, given the balance of forces. According to Argenbright, quote, the whole wretched mess was portrayed as a great victory, which would be embellished for another 70 years. End quote. That judgment is too harsh. A worker militia held Tsaritsyn against a determined onslaught by tens of thousands of Cossacks, armed by German imperialism. And it is significant that Tsaritsyn did not fall to Krasnov. It fell to a different White Army, and in a different context. Tsaritsyn did not just defy Krasnov and the Don Cossack Republic. Along with the Voronezh Front, it defeated them. The Don Cossacks spent all their strength in these attacks, collapsed, and early in 1919 what little was left of their strength was absorbed into the armed forces of southern Russia, under their old rival General Denikin. They were subordinated to the original White Guards, the Volunteers, who had abandoned them in February 1918, whom they had denounced as tramps and pimps, and who had belittled them and called them whores of the Kaiser. But if Tsaritsyn broke Krasnov, my impression is that Andrei Nazarov, the former general who believed the, quote, the people are not mistaken, end quote, had more to do with this outcome than Joseph Stalin. That's it for this week. Thanks for reading or listening. Next week I will drop a post picking up where this one left off and meditating on the theme of terror. This will not be my last word on the subject of terror, that is, on the most controversial and disturbing aspect of the Russian Civil War. But it will go deeper into the themes introduced in this post, and will address some of the unanswered questions.